All right, everybody, welcome. Welcome here to show 165 on Crypto Voices. Happy spring, guys. Michelle, what's going on? Joining us from France, I believe. How you doing?
Hey, what's up, guys? All good here.
And Alec, how you doing over there in Eastern Seaboard?
As well? Summer here, man. It's all good.
Yeah, it's like a little bit warmer here in Eastern good. Europe, but it's finally took a long time. But a lot more than the weather is happening in Bitcoin land for sure. So very happy today to welcome our special guest, Yves Benaim. He is a Bitcoin educator from Switzerland, founder of 2b4ch since 2017, I believe, doing lots on the political implications of Bitcoin in Switzerland, as well as the Bitcoin initiative aimed at adding Bitcoin to the reserves of the Swiss National Bank. Very exciting, right up our alley here, I think, on the show. So very happy to have him on. Yves, welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, pleasure to have you on. We were just chatting pre-show. We've tried to meet a couple times over the years. I believe it's going to happen this time, this year, at one of these conferences, but we'll get to that. So yeah, pretty boring week last week in Bitcoin land. But before we get to it, I just want to kind of jump in on your Bitcoin initiative. I'm not sure exactly how long you've been working on that before you started it, but anything that can, the Swiss National Bank is obviously a benchmark in monetary policy around the world. And if you can work Bitcoin into that, I think that's very exciting. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay. So I started talking about it with someone. So even before me, I don't even know how long it's been in the ether. Like it was an idea that was floating around. People were bumping it to one another since 2021. So it's been a while. And in 2022, I spoke with some people and they all told me, because, you know, it's Switzerland, they all told me you can't be confrontational straight from the beginning. An initiative is I should start with that. An initiative is a way for the people to provoke a vote that will be made by the people. And in order to do that, you need to collect signatures. And if that happens and the vote passes, then you change the constitution. So it's a pretty big deal. So the idea was, of course, when I approached some politicians and some influencing people in the Swiss Bitcoin scene, they all told me you can't just be confrontational. You have to talk to them first. And so since 2022, we've been approaching them. We've been talking publicly, because you can't talk directly to the SNB, first because it's an institution, and second because they really don't care about what I have to say. Someone approached them at the General Assembly, because it's a company, so it has shareholders. So every year there is a General Assembly. So in 2022, we suggested that they added Bitcoin in their reserves. 2023 again, 2024, that was last week, again. Every time they respond, every time they say, well, you know, it's possible. First, they said it's technically possible. It's not a problem. Legally, it's possible. It's just not a good choice. They just don't like the concept of investing in it. So why did it take so long? First, because you need to get everybody on board, because it's a big thing. And now we're going for at least 5 years, 5 to 7 years of procedures. So it's a long-term project. It's not going to be voted next year or in 6 months. It's going to be voted at the earliest in 5 years. So at least one more halving, if you think in in Bitcoin terms. This year is a proper timing, because one, there is the ETF. So the ETF actually invalidates the excuse to say it's not a good investment. If it's a good investment for BlackRock, I think it's a good investment for everybody else on the planet. You cannot say BlackRock doesn't know where to invest their money long term. Also, it's a good investment for BlackRock that they have been fighting, that the SEC had to be sued until they finally accepted they authorized the ETF. So it's not so much a good investment. It's a good investment worth fighting for. as far as the US was concerned. And the other thing that happened this year in 2024 is PostFinance, which is the postal bank, the bank of the post office, which belongs 100% to the state, started offering Bitcoin to their Bitcoin and other cryptos. But, you know, for us, it's Bitcoin that really matters to their customers, to retail customers. So it's like millions of users throughout Switzerland, Mr. and Mrs. John Doe, who can suddenly enable Bitcoin buying, selling, and holding in their normal everyday bank account app. So this is a very big deal because it's not just a cantonal bank or a private bank. It's actually like the bank that belongs to the country. So so now we approached them again and we said, look, it is a big deal. It is a good investment. It is one of the best performing assets in the last 10 to 15 years. It does make sense that you take it into account because Switzerland, the SNB, it doesn't work the same way as the Fed or the ECB. I mean, it's similar, of course. It's a central bank. But one of the things is they have a lot of reserves. They have a lot of money. For those who don't know the Swiss franc, I mean, Switzerland has the Swiss franc. It doesn't belong to the Eurozone. So it is more neutral, quote unquote. It's more independent. But the SNB invests its reserves, a lot of its reserve, like the big majority, in U.S. Treasury bonds, U.S. dollars in general, U.S. dollar denominated stocks, like, you know, the GAFA, Tesla. There is a big story because they have Chevron and ExxonMobil and Shell and Total. So it is like a big story every year with the environment activists who are saying, my Swiss franc, the Swiss franc of my economy, of my country, the one that I have in my pocket is actually subsidizing fracking and, you know, environmental disasters throughout the world. So it is a big thing in terms of the country and the citizens, because the Swiss National Bank is supposed to serve us. So all this, if they were making money, that would be really good. Because, you know, at the end, they can say, we're making money, we know what we're doing. But in the last 2 years, they've been doing losses. And in 2022, they were doing, they had the biggest loss that they had since the creation of the SNB, which was almost three times the highest profit that they made. So it was really a disaster. And so, you know, if you put everything together and you're saying, okay, you're supposed to help the country, the country's economy, you know, employment, all that thing, like this is a central bank, and you're supposed to invest money in order to make that economy stable and fruitful and, you know, moving forward, and you're actually losing money because you're investing in the U.S. economy and the US debt and the European debt, and you're actually losing money on it while at the same time jeopardizing the neutrality and the sovereignty of Switzerland. And at the same time, when the central bank makes money, they redistribute to the Confederation and the cantons. The cantons are the states. So when they're not making money, they're actually not giving money to Switzerland. So in a way, they're subsidizing foreign countries and nations and debt and economies more than they're subsidizing our own economy. So the whole thing is really weird. So what we're doing now is creating that initiative, which means that we need to collect signatures and, you know, make a lot of noise, talk to a lot of people, explain everything. But the idea, of course, is that we can create that discussion. Now we're doing the official direct democracy path. I don't know, like the next step is, you know, very official. So there is no way to ignore this discussion. There is no way to say I'm not interested, or there is no way to say, you know, whatever FUD that we heard before, you know, it's like, it's not liquid, it's not it's too volatile, it's not good for the environment, you know, Greenpeace, all that thing. So the idea is to create that discussion on a national level. And as you were mentioning at the beginning, and I know I talk a lot, but as you were mentioning, it's also a way for Switzerland to lead the way and actually show other countries what's happening. Because I believe that we here have a history of tech and we have a history of banking. And, you know, we're a pretty good country in terms of, you know, stability, democracy, everything. So I think it's really interesting that if we are doing it the proper way here, we could inspire and show the way to other countries throughout the world. Because up until now it was El Salvador, but El Salvador is easy to dismiss because you're saying, oh, it's a small economy, it's a dictatorship. You know, whatever excuse you want to find, you can find with El Salvador. With Switzerland, it's a little bit more difficult. Okay, I stopped my ranting.
No, it's great. I love it. There's so much to follow up on there. Just quickly, maybe like 1 or 2 minutes for those that are curious.
One or two now, sentences.
Back up to the direct democracy and the process that you mentioned to getting to an actual direct democratic vote from, you know, all the citizens of Switzerland, as I understand it. Can you explain just how that works? Because it's pretty interesting how you've kept that over the centuries.
So in Switzerland, we vote a lot. We vote for everything, and there is the votations that are on a national level, on a canton level, or on a commune level. So basically the idea of democracy in Switzerland is that you ask the people all the time. But it goes both ways. Not only the government or local government ask the people all the time, but also the people can provoke a vote. So the idea with a popular initiative, and of course you can also consult the people in order to block something that the government would put forward, which is a different process. But if the government was to say, we want to do this or we want to do that, you can actually get enough people to put this decision to a vote from the people. So what we're doing is we are gathering 100,000 signatures within 18 months from people who vote in Switzerland. So we can get support from everybody, we can do whatever we want, but it needs to be people who will vote, because it needs to be representative of the Swiss, legal, political population. And of course, ideally you want to have, you know, as much communication during that phase, because if you get 100,000 people, but then at the end you only have those 100,000 people who vote yes, nothing's going to pass. So the idea, it's like, it's at the same time you're doing a campaign, which allows you to communicate a lot, and at the same time you're gathering signatures. Then of course that takes 18 months, which is kind of short and kind of long at the same time. And during that time, you need to validate all those signatures with the voting communes. So you're sending the lists of people voting, and everything has to be manuscript. It's very old fashioned, but that's how, you know, you can verify better so that there is no, pre-filled forms, for example, or, you know, forms that you're filling on behalf of someone and they just have to sign, for example, so that they don't know what they're signing. And so you're sending that to the commune send it back to you, you collect it, and then at the end of the 18 month, if you reach the certain amount of signature that you're supposed to have, and you try to have a little bit more, just in case some are invalidated, you're sending it to, you're bringing it to the central government in Bern, in the capital city, and they start looking at it. That's the moment when they start looking at even the validity of the text that you're proposing, which maybe I should mention as well, by the way, what we want to put in the constitution. So they validate everything. They validate the people. They validate that you follow the proper process. They validate that everything is stamped. And then after that, they start discussing internally within the government if it's something that they want to do themselves. Because at the end of the day, maybe you have a good idea. Maybe the thing that I want to point out is we're not trying to we're not trying to attack anyone. We're not trying to be confrontational in a way that we're saying, you know, we want to destroy something. What we want is to make sure that the SNB is being forced to think about something that we think is very important, and that is a way to embrace the future and to, you know, help them make their job better, basically. So that's why the idea originally was to approach them in a very polite and non-confrontational way, so that they know that this is an idea that we want to put forward. And now that they said that they're not interested, we still think, as their bosses, because they work for us, we still think that they should be doing it. So now we're asking the people what the people think. So during that time, of course, the government can come back with, let's say, a counter proposal, or they can come back with all kinds of questions. And there is a negotiation part during 3.5 years. And then after that, if everything is okay, then it goes to the vote, and then people vote, and then it's just counted. And if it passes, then it needs to be implemented, which in this case would be pretty easy. And if it doesn't pass, then, you know, this is the majority of the initiatives. They go all the way to the vote, but at the vote they're being rejected because sometimes they're too in advance, or sometimes they're touching only a certain region of Switzerland and the rest of Switzerland says we're not concerned, we don't want something like that. There is a lot of democracy in Switzerland, from, let's say, the countryside versus the cities. We have four languages, so you know, the Germans can think we should be doing this, and the French and the Italians say we don't want that. So it's a very, very beautiful way of being extremely democratic, but that means it's also very heavy.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating process. And do they still have the votes? I've seen pictures like in the small villages where everybody has to come out. Like they,
of course, the Landsgemeinde, where people actually vote with their hands. Yes, of course.
Would that be the process for this, or does it depend on sort of the issue?
No, this is, I think, only for local now.
Okay, so those are like the local votes, like for some municipal issue.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, fascinating stuff.
So after you go through that whole administrative process, what do you think the actual vote would look like? I mean, are people interested in this with enough quantity to pass it?
If the vote was tomorrow, I don't think it would pass. Most people in Switzerland, and this is how Switzerland works, and it, you know, their reputation exists for a reason. They like the status quo. They like things to move slowly. If you come and you say we're going to change everything, it's not going to work. Most people, believe it or not, most people don't know about Bitcoin, or not as much as we do. So this is what it is. But this is also why you have 5 years to discuss about it. You have 18 months to gather your troops, quote unquote, to make sure that the people who are convinced are following you and supporting you. The people who are not convinced yet, but that you can convince easily, they support the fact that democracy should prevail, and they're happy to sign something, even if they're planning to vote against it, which happens all the time. Like, you know, you gather a signature in the street and you say, we believe this and that. And they say, you know, like, what is it, Voltaire, who said, I don't believe in what you're saying, but I'll fight for you to have the right to say it. So this is really good. But then at the end, they need to think that it's worth changing the constitution for it. And that's a big deal. You're not doing it, you know, without. So if it was tomorrow, I don't think we would have it. But the fact that we have media and politicians and people, you know, moving, stepping up, moving forward and asking questions is already, you know, it's half of what we wanted. What we wanted was that there is a real discussion, that we can debunk things, because otherwise, you know, someone, you know, Brandolini's law, right? It takes order of magnitude to debunk something than debunking itself. So someone says something that makes no sense, and you're going to spend, you know, 10 times the amount of time to try to explain it, but by the time you start, nobody wants to listen anymore. So you need to be part of the conversation. It needs to be a conversation for people to say what you have to say about it. And at the moment, the SMB, they can say whatever they want because we're nobodies. Nobody's going to come and ask us what we think about the SMB's investment strategies. But now that we're starting to have this discussion, they are, quote unquote, obliged to respond to us, to listen to us. People are interested because it's not every day that you're saying the SMB is not doing their job properly. A lot of people think that they're not doing their job properly, but they're not going to say anything because they're, you know, their party is not going to let them, or because they don't want to be ostracized. So it's interesting that it comes from Bitcoiners, so that they will be responding with a lot of, you know, preconceived, prejudiced, biased ideas and FUD that they heard about once. They will be discussing with us, with, you know, big banks whispering in their ears what they should be answering. But people will be paying attention. Now it will be a real conversation. So this I think is very good. Now, as far as the vote itself, I do believe that there is a fair chance that it goes through for two reasons. The first reason is that if it's in 5 years, by then we will probably have at least two bull runs. And people suddenly, when the price goes up, they're very interested in Bitcoin and they're very easy to convince. The second part is by that time, I'm 99.999% convinced that the SMB will have Bitcoin in their portfolio anyway, because, you know, at the end of the day, you can say whatever you want. They're not idiots. They see something, yeah. It goes up, everybody's buying it. And it's not like in Switzerland, we don't have, I don't know, like 30 banks that actually offer that to their customers. So, you know, technically it's really not a problem. Legally, it's completely legal. It's completely acceptable in Switzerland to hold Bitcoin. It's taxed properly. By the way, in Switzerland, we're not taxed on capital gain. It's taxed on your wealth. So if you're wealthy, you pay more, of course. But people can buy, sell, and spend, which is a big thing for certain countries, like let's say France, for example. When you buy something, you buy a croissant. Technically, it's a taxable event. So technically, you should be declaring your whole portfolio before and after, so that they can look at the price, at the amount of your whole portfolio straight from the beginning when you started buying it, with the whole history, and then evaluate the gain that you made by selling it to the baker when you exchanged it for your croissant. So it's a big mess. In Switzerland, we don't have all that. In Switzerland, it's like all the big banks now are maybe not UBS and Pictet, but that's about it. Everybody else is offering, and we were the first country with two banks, one day separate. So nobody knows exactly which one was the first one, but two banks were the first ones, the first regulated banks in the world offering Bitcoin to their customers.
Which were?
It was Falcon and Swissquote. And I think Falcon exploded, but Swissquote is still there and they're still the leader. And of course, at the very beginning, they were offering that you couldn't, you know, like Revolut, that you couldn't put your external Bitcoin in or out or whatever. Now it's like completely, like it's all over the place. If I can step for 1 second, they actually have a debit card now, which is MasterCard, if I'm not mistaken, that you can have your Bitcoin and or crypto on your account as Bitcoin. And whenever you're using your card, they actually sell it on the spot, on demand, So they reinvented the whole concept of money, you know, like money, store of value and medium of exchange. So you have your store of value on one hand, you have your medium of exchange on the other, and they're in the middle doing it live whenever the event happens. So again, all this, sorry, I'm going all over the place, but
that's great.
All this to say, in Switzerland, we are very comfortable with this. And there is no way that people at the SNB don't know that and don't see that and don't follow that. I mean, they're working with banks. They know what's happening. So by the time that it goes to a vote, they will have had in the news somewhere that the SNB already bought Bitcoin. And by that time, they will say, well, you know, it was our idea all along, but we were preparing it, blah, blah, blah. We were waiting for the right timing. No problem. And maybe we will never know if we actually push them a little bit, if we nudge them in the right direction, that they did it a little bit faster. But by the time the vote comes, it will already be perceived as obsolete. But if we want to go back to the actual text of the initiative of the amendment to the Constitution, it's actually two words. Because at the moment in the Constitution, it says that the Swiss National Bank has to have reserves. That's compulsory by law. And it has to have, but it doesn't say how much, which is kind of interesting. No percentage, no amount, no nothing. And it says some of its reserves, and again, no amount, no percentage, needs to be in gold. And recently, I think it was 10 years ago, there was a vote to discuss about the amount of gold. And it was also an initiative. It was rejected. I think it actually came from a political party, so it was a big thing. But it was rejected because people were saying, you know, we need fractional reserve, we need to be floating, we need to be competitive in the world, we can't just have like a very strong Swiss franc and no export and no tourism and no nothing. So it was rejected. So this is why the initiative, the constitution now is still very not precise. It just says some of it needs to be in gold. And what we want to add is at the end is just end Bitcoin. And that's it.
Nice.
So it doesn't say it needs to be the same amount, gold or Bitcoin. It doesn't say any amount, doesn't say any proportion. It just says you need to have some Bitcoin. And of course, the idea when people will say, yeah, but you need to put how much? Well, it's, you know, we're in a democracy. We want the S&B to have some wiggle room and some, you know, decisional power. We want them to be able to know what they're doing because they still know what they're doing. And we put them in charge so that they can do their job the best way they can. You know, imagine it fit, right? Yeah. So we don't want to tell them what to do. But what we want them to do is to make sure that they cannot ignore it. And that in the future, they will be not the last one when everybody will be moving very, very fast.
Yeah. A quick aside for me, by the way, the theory of myth busting and debunking, by the way, is all that the Russians practice. I mean, 10 years ago when they shut down the MH17, they had about 50 different reasons why they didn't do that. And, you know, trying to debunk each one of those 50 reasons takes some time, even if it's so obvious that they did, and can go on down the list. But that's not what this show is about today. But it's a very real thing. It's going, I totally hear what you're saying as far as the amount of time and effort that it takes to address people's questions, you know, especially about something as benign as Bitcoin, right? So it's a real effort that you guys are putting in there. Just a little bit more, you almost answered the question about the two words about and Bitcoin, but I just want to remind our listeners and viewers, because, you know, this is one of the things that I study a lot. Like, I was actually in Switzerland a couple months ago, great place as always. And I overheard, Swiss German, I was in Zurich at the time, overheard him just talking with someone in English, about how great the Swiss banking system was, you know, just regular dinner talk, and saying this person said, you know, every Swiss franc that is issued is 100% one-to-one backed by gold. And I don't know if he's a Swiss German or German, is a multi-ethnic table, but obviously that's not true. Just to remind our listeners how this works, it's never going to be one-to-one ever. If you're talking banking, it's assets, liabilities, it's never, ever going to be one-to-one. It was never one-to-one in the gold standard era, all the rest. So the gold, I don't know if you know the latest figures, Eve. It's probably a pretty big minority. You know, you have liabilities, which is the money, and then the assets that you buy with that money. It's probably a pretty big minority, is an oxymoron, but it's probably not that large of a share of their assets at the moment.
Gold is around 6% now. It was 5%. But they reduced a little bit the reserve and they increased a little bit the gold. So now it's around 6%. What is interesting, though, is, as you said, it was never one-to-one, even during the gold standard. But what a lot of people don't know is that Switzerland was the last country to abandon the gold standard
in 2000, right?
In 2000.
Yeah.
So it really means that you can be on a gold standard. Like, mm-hmm. one of the things that people say, you know, Bitcoin is horrible because you guys want to go back to the gold standard, and gold standard is like so old-fashioned and it never worked, and, you know, like, you're going to build pyramids and whatnot, right? Right, but Switzerland was successful and productive and rich and healthy and wealthy and safe and democratic up until 2000, when the whole world was 100% fiat, and yet we were still on the gold standard. So the gold standard, as you said, doesn't need to be one-on-one. But there is an empirical proof that you can be on the gold standard and still be, or you can be backed by some kind of commodity to a certain degree, and still be, you know, prosperous and successful.
Yeah, and it's always a question of degree. It's just, there's no other way around it, unless you talk about 100% reserve banking, which has never worked anyway. But this is a rabbit hole that many gold and Bitcoin economists, I believe, who don't even understand it themselves, get into. But you know the numbers, so it's great to hear. Yeah, so 6% is what it is now. I mean, you can just imagine the numbers that we're playing around with here. I mean, if you're moving Bitcoin up to 6%, obviously that's huge. It's a huge boon for the market, and it lends even more credibility to the asset. So it's absolutely huge, I think, and important what you're doing. So I don't know if I have a question baked in after that. I just want to make that point.
If you want an anecdote.
Yeah.
So Lucius Meiser, who is part of the committee, who is the chairman of the company Bitcoin Swiss, who was one of the first regulated exchange in Switzerland and in the world.
Is this the gentleman that owns a tank? Is that correct? Or is that someone else? One of them from Bitcoin Swiss bought a tank. Sorry to interrupt your
So
flow,
that's but. Possible, but then it would be the founder. It would be
I think
Niklas.
It was the founder. Yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
It would was be the founder. Niklas. Yes. Because Niklas is a character, is an interesting character. But no, Lucius is very, very Zurich serious person. I don't think he has a tank.
Okay.
But he was the one who went to the General Assembly of the SNB to talk to them. So in 2022, the year where they had their record losses, he actually said in his speech, we are not saying you should go all in. We're not saying you should go, you know, backing every Swiss franc one-on-one. What we're proposing, as an example, is that you do DCA like, you know, your normal average pleb. So he actually suggested that they remove 1 billion Swiss franc from the European bonds and invest 1 billion every month in Bitcoin. And he actually published a Google sheet publicly, where he's following every month the price of Bitcoin and the price of the euro bond and blah, blah, blah. And he's making the calculation of, you know, the current situation where they actually kept it, and the hypothetical situation where they would have bought Bitcoin with it. And 2 years later, when he did his presentation this year, he made a calculation, and they would have, of course, it's 2 years, so it's 24 billion Swiss francs, right? Easy to calculate. They would be in profit of over 30, I forgot if it's 34 or 38 billion Swiss franc compared to the Eurobond, if they DCA'd into Bitcoin 1 billion a month. So even with very simple numbers and going back in time and actually telling them, look, this is something that you should be doing because you're not going to spook the market. You're not going to make everything go crazy. You're not going to make your own investment in other things, you know, collapse by doing that, because this is also a real risk. They're very afraid, because they're such a big investor. They're very afraid that if they sell something, it creates such a ripple effect that everything would collapse including other stocks or including other bonds, right? Because if Switzerland, if it's known that Switzerland is selling whatever, let's say Tesla, there is a chance that everybody is selling Tesla because, you know, the market gets spooked. So in that particular case, if it was 1 billion a month, it would have been nothing. And if it was 1 billion a month coming into Bitcoin, it would have been nothing because the Bitcoin market is liquid enough to absorb it. But yeah, it would have been like a 30 billion profit. So good investment, bad investment. I would like to have 30 billion, I have to confess.
I just have a couple of quick follow-up questions about the whole process and the numbers. Like, how many signatures do you actually need to collect?
100,000.
100,000, okay. And about the percentage you said, like gold and Bitcoin and no minimum or maximum, don't you think that there is no some minimum set that we can just like buy one BTC and said, okay, job done?
In reality, I wish they do that. It would create even more conversation. They could buy one franc worth of Bitcoin. And that would be the conversation where we say, hey, you figured out Bitcoin is divisible.
Taking a moment to remind you that this show is brought to you by Trezor, home of the original Bitcoin hardware wallet. For over 10 years now, Trezor means business in Bitcoin security and functionality. When using their wallet software, Trezor Suite, to connect to the Bitcoin network, you're automatically connected via Tor, protecting your identity and giving you full control of your coins in a fully open source manner, both on the software level and on the hardware level. So head on over to Trezor.io to grab your Trezor Safe 3 with a secure element, Model T with a touchscreen, or the original Trezor 1, as well as a ton of available accessories to back up your keys and keep your coins safe. This show is proud to be associated with Trezor.
So I would like that they do that. What I would like is that they are saying we are forced to do it because, you know, like the people have voted and they have chosen and now we have to do it. And we think it's not a good idea, but we're doing it anyway. And then after that, there is a bull run. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, it doesn't matter. It will happen. As we all know, the dollar and the euro are going down. So Bitcoin and gold can only go up, like, you know, just by the nature of mathematics. So in that case, people would actually start paying attention and saying, look, how come you didn't buy more? You had the mandate, you had the excuse, you had the means to do it, and you wanted to play dumb. And now you cost money to the confederation and the cantons and the people. This is not wise. Why are you doing something like that? Like, why are you petty? I wish that they are petty so that people can say, why are you petty? But in reality, what I really wish is that because they have the excuse, they will say, we'll just do it normally and we're not stupid. At the moment, they can always say, we don't want to do it. But once they say, we don't want to do it, but we're forced to, they have economists, they have, you know, market maker, whatever, analysts who can do it properly, and they will do it properly.
Hmm. And sorry if you already mentioned that, but how far along in the process are you right now?
So we're very early. We have the committee. Sorry, we have the committee, but we want to have a more representative committee. We need academics, we need women, because we know that we will be attacked on, you know, the crypto bro thing, and we will be attacked on if they are, like, you know, politicians from the left will be, you know, communists. If there are politicians from the right, will be, you know, bankers who want the poor people to become even poorer. So we're really trying to have a committee that is very broad and representative. We want that it's the majority of normal people, not Bitcoin professionals or bankers or politicians. So that's why we haven't completely finalized. The second thing is, even though it's only two words, what I mentioned earlier is that when we do submit the 100,000 signatures, that's the moment when they actually evaluate our proposal. And if there is any kind of weirdness in the text, they could refuse it, saying it cannot be part of the constitution. You should have, you know, consulted a lawyer before. So we want to be 100% sure and, you know, document and go back and forth, even maybe with them informally, formally, to make sure that those two words, the way they are formulated, are good, and that they don't say, oh, it's, you know, if you had three words, it would have been okay, but two words is not enough because it's, I don't know, too blurry or whatever. So we want to make sure that everything is okay before we start getting the 100,000 signatures or before we start the campaign for it. And the other thing with this is that once you publish the initiative text and the fact that it exists, you cannot change anyone in the committee. Nobody can leave, nobody can join. And the 18 months start and that's it. So if you start, let's say, the day before Christmas, it's a bit silly. You might as well just wait and start in February when people are, you know, come back from holiday and everybody is happy and you can get their attention. If you're doing it at a time when it's, you know, non-productive, it makes no sense because the 18 months are not extensible. So it also matters when you will be finishing your campaign, because you know that at the beginning there will be a lot of enthusiasm. At the end, you will need to, you know, maybe do a little bit of marketing to get all the signatures that you didn't get, and you know that, you know, it's the finishing line coming. So you want to make sure that your finishing line also doesn't happen during Christmas break, right? So we want to make sure, because now we know it's the right time, but we have two problems. First is, as I was saying, you know, when you start, when you finish. And second, there is a Bitcoin cycle and we can't go against it, because if by the time we need, you know, let's say we have 90,000 signatures and we want to make a little campaign to make sure that we finish properly, and that's the moment when we peak and all the newspapers are saying Bitcoin is crashing, you know, all the Bitcoiners are going to commit suicide, nobody's going to sign. So we need to make sure that we're not, you know, missing the right timing so that we can finish on a up note. And that's why we need to do it as soon as possible, because nobody knows when the peak is going to be. Even, of course, we can extrapolate, but nobody really knows when it's going to be. And we don't want that it's going to be used against us. And it will be used against us after the campaign. When we do get the 100,000 signatures, there will be a moment during the 3.5 years where it's going to go down. And that will be the moment when, you know, the SNB will say, see, we told you. And the government will say, the people should not vote for something like this because they were very enthusiastic during the bull run. But now, of course, we see the reality of the story, which is that it collapsed and it was just a bubble and blah, blah, blah. So ideally, what we would like is that we can time it so perfectly that the voting actually would happen on an up note again, so that we can say, see, of course it was a bubble. Of course there was a reaction to the bubble when it burst and people got their profit. This is normal. This is a market. And it's going to be the same with any kind of market. But look, it's going back up again. And if we could have the vote when it's going back up properly, that would be fantastic, because people would, you know, be optimistic and receptive again. So that's why we haven't actually started the campaign, because it takes a little bit of, I don't know, magic to find the right timing to do it. And we also want to be sure that it doesn't get invalidated.
Yeah, the timing stuff is interesting. And if you look at like buying Amazon stock during the tech bubble, you know, you would have lost a lot of money in the near term, and you would have done great over the next 10 years, right? So exactly. It's all relative. But can we talk a little about Swiss banking secrecy? Is that in your wheelhouse?
Kind of.
I'm just curious about it superficially. So for the longest time, that veil was seen as kind of impenetrable, and you had your numbered accounts, and for better or worse, and in my opinion, for better, right? But you can make counter arguments. The Swiss bank was the most private place to put your money. And that's probably still true, but I think in 2017, there was some dispensation allowed for piercing that veil for the purposes of identifying folks that were hiding assets from being taxed. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes. So what happens is, of course, there is the extraterritoriality of the dollar, right? And there were some people who were abusing this, quote unquote, abusing the system, you know, like not paying taxes and whatnot. And of course, the way to address that is to say you need to protect people from terrorism and child pornography and. So what happened was Switzerland was put on a gray list or threatened to be put on a gray list, which was the gray list where, you know, you have all the countries, let's say like the Bahamas and Cayman Islands and everything, which means that everything that you have to do, you have to make an extra effort for it. And it wasn't really good, you know, like when you're exporting, I don't know, pharmaceuticals and whatnot, you don't want to be, if the only thing you're doing is banking, it could be okay because, you know, you don't really care. But if you actually want to have a proper economy in the world, it's very difficult. So there was a like arm wrestling. And the current situation, the compromise is that there is no bank secrecy for foreign nationals, or foreign companies. So that means that, for example, if you have a bank account in Switzerland and you're French, every year your bank will send the information about your assets and you know, everything to your tax authorities automatically, and it has to happen, and it's automatic, and that's it. But there is bank secrecy for Swiss people and Swiss residents and Swiss companies, which is why everybody's going to Zug and creating a foundation, by the way. This is, you know, like Ethereum, Cardano, all of those. They just follow a lot of companies who are doing exactly the same thing. They go there, they get a lawyer, they get a mailbox, they create an entity in Zug, and taxes are low, because also, even if you do pay taxes, Zug is well known for having low taxes, and they benefit from the Swiss banking secret. What did I want to say about that? I forgot. But yeah, I think that sums up my answer to what you were asking.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. But still, in spite of that, the laws in Switzerland are very rigorous in the punishments that apply to bankers or really anyone for sharing information about Swiss bank accounts outside of this, like, I think it was called the AEOI, right? Which is the this tax-related account sharing. But you still accrue a lot of privacy by having an account there in spite of this change in 2017, right?
Yeah. But in general, if you have a bank account in Switzerland and you're a Swiss resident or Swiss citizen, you don't really worry about it. Let me put it this way. If you are in Switzerland and you pay taxes in Switzerland, then you don't really worry about it. And the Swiss tax authorities don't ask your bank about your details, and you're supposed to declare it. And of course, it's illegal not to declare it and to, you know, evade taxes. And I'm not, you know, advocating for that at all. But there is like a separation between the government, taxes, and the banking system, where your banking is your business. And then whatever needs to be taxed, of course, you need to pay taxes on it. But whatever you're using your money for is, you know, is your own. So it's that cypherpunk thing about, you know, the difference between a secret and privacy. It's not necessarily a secret, but it's private. But at the end, you still need to declare how much money you made, and you're paying taxes on it. The thing is, if you are, let's say, a U.S. citizen, and you're still paying taxes in the U.S., and you have a bank account in Switzerland, then it becomes a hassle for the Swiss bank. And this is why, you know, like that you try to protect people, and at the end you start hurting them at the same time. So, for example, you have like fixed, rent. And because the rent is so low, The owner, the real estate owner, doesn't want to rent it to anybody because the rent is too low. And then you start having like empty apartments because you want to help people access low rent. So it's kind of like the same. The US wants to make sure that their residents are not evading taxes by having a Swiss bank account. And it creates so much hassle with compliance and with admin to the banks that now they're just saying, you know what, if you're American or if you're American citizen resident, if you're someone who is important in the US, we just don't want to do business with you. And it's just easier this way. And with Europe, for example, they have a deal where if you have a bank account in Europe, because, of course, we have a lot of people, for example, who are working in Switzerland, but living in Germany or in France and going back and forth or in Italy or the opposite. So, of course, there are some agreements between the EU and Switzerland and even with the US where Switzerland says, OK, we accept people having bank accounts. We accept people doing banking activities in our country. But whatever you do, we're sending it to your tax authorities. And it's not like you don't have to do anything. Of course, as a, you know, a taxpayer, you still need to make your declaration and whatnot. But as the bank goes, they don't want to be, they don't want to be back on the gray list. But second, they don't want to be on a blacklist where, you know, it's like with North Korea and Iran and whatnot. So they're just saying, we are taking care of our own citizens and our own residents, but everybody else is just fair game that we're sharing with your tax authorities, and that's your problem, that's not ours.
Yeah, well, the joke here is that you do all this work to file your tax returns, and then the IRS comes back and corrects you. And if they already knew the answer in the beginning, why didn't they just send an invoice?
Exactly. And if you make a mistake on what they think you should be declaring, you're going to federal jail anyway. So.
Speaking of which, got arrested last week, the founders of Samurai Wallet, on charges of conspiracy to commit money laundering for running the Whirlpool mixing coordinators, and also for a feature in the wallet, which is the Ricochet feature, if I remember correctly. So one of them is currently in jail in the US. The second one is in Portugal, waiting to be extradited. Any thoughts on that and what it implies for Bitcoin and for privacy in general?
You're asking whom?
All of you.
I'm not clear about the Portugal thing. I'm not sure. Was the person in Portugal a US citizen? Do you know?
So he is a US citizen. Okay. He happens to be in Portugal at the time of the facts.
Because
he used to live in Paris, which is not a secret anymore since it's all around in the documents published by the US government. And he was in Portugal last week.
So that's what I was missing. I thought it was a French person. And I thought, wow, this is like a French person.
No, they're both US citizens.
In Europe, being extradited to the US. That's pretty crazy. But okay, so he's a US citizen. The problem with Samurai is that they are like the canary in the gold mine, right? Or in the coal mine. They were a very obvious canary. So it's good that at least it actually works as intended. It's very not good for the people involved, obviously. But yeah, like now, I don't know, you saw that Phoenix, Async, mm-hmm. Async? Decided that they're not going to be having US users anymore. Like,
yeah, Wasabi did the same.
Wasabi does the same. So at the end of the day, it goes back to what I was saying earlier with the Swiss bank secrecy. People are just saying, if you are in the US, you're a US company, then you deal with the US. And if you're not in the US, then we're not interested in the US. And it's quite interesting. And the response from Jack Dorsey, who actually quote tweeted Phoenix, and he said, yeah, this is like that, I don't know what he said, like this is a bit much or something, like this seems a bit exaggerated.
Seems unnecessary.
Unnecessary, exactly. And I think it's not a healthy answer. I think he's in the US and he's, a big US company, like what is it, a Square? But at the same time, I think he has been on the other side of this story when he was CEO of Twitter and he had, the FBI coming and saying, you have to give us the list of the people who are saying this and that. You have to censor and deplatform people who are saying this and that. And it wasn't money laundering. It was people saying the vaccine doesn't work 100%. And suddenly they were deplatformed, right?
Yeah, I mean, his businesses, including Square, clearly are compliant and follow KYC AML rules.
Exactly. So. But he kind of knows what it feels, and he kind of knows that the US can be very heavily, breathing over your shoulder when you're doing business. And if you are, let's say, in France, then you say, well, I don't want to have that kind of hassle. If anything, when he said unnecessary, yeah, it's unnecessary to have that kind of hassle for the US market if you're in Europe and everywhere else in the world. So I thought it was not nice. It was not good what he answered. And I think this is what we're going to have now, like people in the Bitcoin world fighting over, is the US, doing what they should be doing, and the samurai people were just poking a bear and it's their own fault and whatever. And all you have to do is, plug your API with Chainalysis, and if you have nothing to hide, if you have no secret, if you have nothing to worry about, that will be one narrative. I expect that Coinbase will take that narrative. I expect that Lightspark will take that narrative, especially now that they're in bed together. I expect that everyone who has A16Z behind them is going to take that narrative, because it's the US market, it's US companies, and they don't want to be the next target of any kind of procedure. Like, we just need to check now all your customers. So they don't want that. So they're going to play nice. And then Europe will be saying, we don't want to deal with the US anymore. And sorry, not sorry. If you want to be part of us, then move or get a VPN or get out of your own country, and I think it's the divide and conquer strategy. If too many people in Bitcoin are all over the place, first thing you do is you create a divide between them, which was already the case with Wasabi and Samurai for a very long time, and now they're kind of like on the same side.
Yeah, I mean, this whole blocking the US thing is a joke anyway, because there are VPNs, there is Tor. The Wasabi coordinator actually is Tor only, so they have no way of knowing that you're in the US. The only thing they can do is prevent you from downloading the software from their own website.
Yeah.
But you can still get it from other places, so nobody cares.
So that's the next thing. Will Phoenix have to not distribute their app on... sorry, I'm trying to make a sentence, but it's complicated. Will they remove, or will they be forced to remove their app from the European or the non-US shops of Apple and Google, who are American companies?
That's a good question. For now, they removed it as White of Satoshi did from the US store, but
exactly
what will happen to the international ones?
And actually, yeah, the canary on the gold mine was a Wallet of Satoshi. Actually, it wasn't like the second one was Samurai. But yeah. At the moment, people are not discussing yet the fact that we are using U.S. based software in our pocket at all times. Mm. Pretty much all of us.
What's also interesting in this case is that, as far as I know, Samurai didn't have any entity operating in the US. The servers were in Iceland, the founders were in Europe and UK. And what happened when I read the indictment is that some undercover agent made one transaction using Samurai, like to anchor the case in the New York State. Someone explained to me that's what they usually do. And if you have a good lawyer, you can actually get rid of the case pretty easily. Maybe Alec has some insight on that.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing of like creating jurisdiction wherever you think that the prosecution has the biggest advantage, and New York makes sense, in particular the Southern District, because Letitia James is, you know, very happy to go after crypto. And whether you are on Team DCG or not, right, like Letitia James pretty famously has a big case against Barry Silbert in DCG, and has prosecuted other, you know, Genesis, Gemini, like, the, you know, if you are a New York based crypto company, you're very much under her watch.
Yeah, I remember in some time some crypto companies were not doing business in New York specifically.
That was because of the BIT license. So New York had this, they started that years ago. That might have been 2017 or earlier, where if you wanted to operate a crypto, and it was not the same as a money or the MSB or the money transfer MSB, license.
Yeah
MSB. So it was in addition to that. So there were companies that basically operated in 49 states. And then there was a smaller cohort that you typically were better funded and could deal with the compliance and the legal that would then also operate in New York. And so that included Kraken, that included Gemini, that included Coinbase, etc.
Yeah, and I'm actually not sure that Wasabi is safe either, because even with the... So my first reaction was like, okay, they have this chain analysis thing, so they can prove like that good faith that they are doing something. But actually, Tornado Cash was also using chain analysis to back blacklist addresses, so, and it didn't help them at all.
Let me... I was thinking about this. Let me give the old Satoshi quote from... This is like 7 days after he released the white paper. This is November 7th, 2008. I don't know if you guys remember this one. This one always stuck with me when I was reading through the early mailing list. He was responding to someone who was all worried about the government shutting down their project, and they wrote, I forget who it was, but they wrote, "You will not find a solution to political problems in cryptography." Then he responds, "Yes, but we can win a major battle in the arms race and gain a new territory of freedom for several years. Governments are good at cutting off the heads of a centrally controlled network like Napster, but pure P2P networks like Nutella and Tor seem to be holding their own." Do you think it's like, have we reached a new territory of freedom for several years? Are we at the end of several years?
I think we're at the beginning of several years. I think we're now is, you know, as the price will be going up, the crackdown will be going up as well. But to go back to the initiative and the fact that, you know, some people will see me as a politician now, which I'm not, or a statist cuck, which I'm not, and a libertarian on the other side, which I'm not, and I'm a little bit of all of it. But one of the thing is the narrative is always, what if the government? Which government? You cannot say the government, because, for example, what's happening now in El Salvador, and nobody knows what's happening tomorrow, but what's happening in El Salvador is different from what's happening in Switzerland, which is different from what's happening in the US. People say the government when they mean the US. And a lot of those people are in the US, so obviously it makes sense. But when you're outside of the US and you say the government when you mean the US, you're de facto putting it like if it was the world government, which in reality it may behave like, and, you know, sometimes it does one way or the other, but it technically it isn't. And the reason why it behaves like that since, you know, 1944, and we all know the story about Bretton Woods and everything, is slowly eroding. And Bitcoin is part of this erosion. So one of the thing about the initiative at the moment is that, and it wraps up a little bit of many things we discussed. It also wraps up the bank secrecy. Part of the bank secrecy thing was No problem. If you want to keep the bank secrecy and just be on the gray list, no problem. But from now on, you can't export anything to outside of Switzerland or, you know, outside of a few amount of countries, and especially not in the US. And if you can't export, you know, your biggest exports is chemical and pharmaceutical and everything. And, you know, it's a big problem for your economy. Of course, you're going to give a little bit in order to keep your freedom to do commerce. So one of the things that's happening with, you know, the BRICS recently is that they reach that stage where it's not just one country. It's not like Iran saying we want to sell in something else than the dollar, and then there is a war, and then, you know, or there is a coup, and then there is like Gaddafi saying I want to sell in my own currency, but in the first step will be to sell in euro, and then suddenly he was the coolest guy in the world, and then he's like enemy number one and he's assassinated. Now with the BRICS, you cannot have, like, now it's like a little bit more balanced. And I think Bitcoin also brings that. And if Switzerland was to bring Bitcoin to a government level, it also brings a little bit of balance. And again, I'm not saying, you know, destroy the US or fight the US or whatever. I'm just saying it shouldn't be that the US is the de facto government for the rest of the world. Because we are living in different jurisdictions, and if something is legal somewhere else, then the US should not say it's illegal with us, therefore from now on we will do everything to destroy you wherever you are on the planet. It's not good. It's not a healthy democratic world balance. And I'm not saying, you know, like, let's all move to North Korea or China, but I think it is kind of good that there is a balance so that we go back to bipolar, tripolar world balance, where the US has a certain kind of authority and reach to the rest of the world, but not 100%. And in the case of Samurai, the fact that they are US citizens, that's one thing. But if, let's say, Async was more comfortable because they were saying we're in Europe and Europe is strong, and Europe is protecting us because the laws in Europe are, you know, very, very clear, and we're following them, and what we're doing is good. And they were not afraid of the US, which is why the reaction was a little bit, you know, in haste and a little bit exaggerated, maybe. But if they were not afraid of the US and they were just saying, you know, from now on, if you come from the US, you have to do this, this and that. And if you are not in the US, then you don't have to do this, this and that. And it's fine. Like visas, like when you enter a country and you come from certain countries, you need a visa. If you come from other countries, you don't need a visa. But that should be the sovereignty of the country where you are, where you operate. And it shouldn't be something where there is like, I don't know, a soft power that is forcing you to apply laws that are not your local laws. And I'm saying that as a Swiss because, you know, we're neutral, blah, blah, blah. And we have a history.
Easy for you to say.
Blah, blah, blah. It's easy for me to say, but that's my point. I am in Switzerland, a Swiss citizen, where there is that initiative system with direct democracy. It's my duty to do this. I cannot just look and say, you know, it sucks to be an American, because, well, it doesn't always suck, but I can't just have that Twitter, you know, reaction to say, well, you know, sucks for democracy, sucks for the US. I actually have a responsibility as a Swiss person to take the Swiss system, which is so unique, and actually lead and actually make that Switzerland becomes an inspiration for other countries to get. And by the way, we're number two. Like, if anything, El Salvador was the first one. They were the first one to adopt it. They were the first one to decriminalize, de-dramatize it. They were the first one to have it in their central bank. They were the first one to make it public. So if anything, Switzerland is sucking. But if Switzerland could be the first one in the quote-unquote, you know, Western, Northern, whatever you want to call it, world, it would be so good for everybody else, I think. So I think it's also a duty to do it so that conversation can happen. And if nobody's doing it, if everybody's talking about it all the time, but nothing happens, then, you know, whoever is the strongest and the most threatening wins.
I think it's a good spot to end it, Eve. Very interesting thoughts. Switzerland is a great place, very unique, and definitely wish you guys all the best in your endeavors there. So yeah, listen, as we close out, any final thoughts? Where can our listeners and viewers find out more about what you're doing?
So on Twitter, I'm Zlok, Z-L-O-K. My name is Benaim. It will be, I guess, in the show notes. You can find my website. There is links to whatever. The initiative on Twitter is Initiative BTC. On Telegram is it's a group, Initiative BTC. On the website is initiativebtc.com, but at the moment, no, .ch. I'm not even sure because I'm building the website, but I think I actually got both, but don't quote me on it. Get the link, click the link, it's better. But yeah, the idea, of course, is that we will need people from within Switzerland to support us because we need more signatures and we need more spreading the word. But we also need a lot of people from outside of Switzerland to spread the word and, as I said, to make sure that Switzerland's efforts are beneficial for everybody else in the rest of the world. So wherever you're from, please reach out, please come, please participate in the conversation. Because we're doing it for Bitcoin. We're not doing it for us. We're not doing it 100% for Switzerland. We're doing it for Bitcoin in general and Bitcoiners worldwide.
Fascinating stuff, Eve. Really appreciate you coming on. And
thank you.
Hope to talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Great to hear you.